Good morning and welcome to this chapel service. Today we will be hearing from Alyssa Mezick, who has been doing an independent study this semester on theology and motherhood. And she will be sharing reflections on motherhood with us. I invite you to stand and join me in Psalm 36, and then we'll stay standing and sing together, God of Eve and God of Mary. Your steadfast love, O Lord, extends to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds.
Your righteousness is like the mighty mountains. Your judgments are like great deep. You save humans and animals alike, O Lord.
How precious is your steadfast love, O God. All people may take refuge in the shadow of your wings.
They feast on the abundance of your house, and you give them drink from the river of your delights.
For with you is the fountain of life. In your light we see light. O continue your steadfast love to those who know you, and your salvation to the upright.
Answer me when I call out to you, my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Have mercy on me and hear my prayer. Fill my heart with joy. In peace I will lie down and sleep. For you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. Do we hear this text when we live in a culture that judges our babies' goodness and our mothers' competence based on the extent to which our babies can fall asleep and stay asleep without their mother's comfort? I'll read it again. Answer me when I call out to you, my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Have mercy on me and hear my prayer. Fill my heart with joy and peace. I will lie down and sleep. For you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. Joan Chittister wrote in Wisdom Distilled from the Daily that truth is a mosaic of the face of God. I suspect that most parenting styles reveal some part of God. This is my story. This is Adam. We will be celebrating his first birthday on Sunday. I couldn't imagine sharing this story, this sermon, without his presence. I've been a little anxious about parenthood. I have desperately tried to get it right. As such, I've read lots of books and browsed many an internet site. And before he was born, I knew how to seamlessly integrate Adam into our lives. I knew how to provide him with just the right amount of stimulation for optimal brain development. And I knew how to protect his precious little tender bum with undyed organic cotton prefolds. And then my labor was over 50 hours and included Pitocin, Nubain, and an epidural. So, right after he was born, Adam didn't eat very well. And then he was a newborn, and so he didn't sleep very well. And so I started reading again and asking for advice from seasoned mothers. I found and heard strong warnings urging me not to follow my instincts, which might lead me to nurse when my baby cried, allow him to fall asleep at the breast, or pick him up when he wanted to be held. They said that such behavior would cause my child, my baby, to become dependent upon me and overly attached. One of the baby whisperers describes routinely helping a baby fall asleep by rocking, bouncing, cuddling, or nursing as accidental parenting. The general consensus is that babies must learn to self-soothe in order to get enough sleep. And they must get enough sleep in order for their brains to develop. Of course, self-soothe means not being soothed by a loving caregiver. A quick search reveals that the vast majority of all sleep training advice is some variation on the demand that a child learn to self-soothe by crying himself to sleep alone in his crib. Right after the warning not to allow my baby to become dependent on me, I read that it wouldn't take long for him to master the art of manipulation through tears. The antidote, naturally, is to become less responsive to his cries, to not hold him quite as often as he would like, and by no means feed him when he asked to be nursed. This last year, my husband and I participated in a parenting class offered at my church that gave the advice a more Christian flavor. It taught that babies, like all of us, are born with the seed of selfishness in our hearts, and that one of the primary goals of parenting an infant is to keep these seeds from taking root and developing into full-blown self-centeredness by teaching the baby self-control early on. One of the primary tools used in this teaching is having the baby learn patience on cue by submitting to parent-directed feedings instead of parents taking their cues from the child. Something didn't feel quite right about all of this. I understood that teaching Adam self-control and patience were important, but I worried about emphasizing these too early. My faith formation classes had convinced me that the primary job of parents during infancy isn't necessarily to teach self-control, but to provide the child with a foundational experience of God. Similarly, I could see the benefit in breaking a baby's suck-to-sleep association. There's certainly something healthy and glorious about a child learning to fall asleep on his own, I would imagine. I even believe that letting a toddler cry in his crib can be appropriate, or even a baby at times. But I was beginning to reject the claim that it should be our go-to parenting style, or that it is the way of growing kids God's way, which was the title of that class I took at my church, because it requires that parents bypass both their and their baby's instincts, which I believe were hardwired into them by a brilliant creator who designed mothers in God's image to reflect God's care for God's children. I will read that again. It requires that parents bypass both their and their baby's instincts, which were hardwired into them by a brilliant creator who designed mothers in God's image to reflect God's care for God's children. Anytime we intentionally bypass something that God has designed into us, I think we would be wise to be sure we have good reasons for that decision, and then to be honest about the potential costs. The need to care for older children is a very legitimate reason to pick up the pace of sleep training, as are obligations that take us away from home or require us to do other things besides work on sleep. Let's just be honest in naming these competing realities and considering the potential costs. I think the reason I was so aware of the value of our instincts is because in the past few years, I have become a gardener and a chicken mama. And in those roles, I have observed that most all living organisms, from legumes that fix nitrogen in the soil to my baby chicks, they all naturally crave that which helps them to thrive. Babies are born wanting to suck and be held. It didn't seem wise to me to limit these activities very much. Now, even in God's creation, things don't always work perfectly. Seeds don't always germinate. Eggs don't always hatch. Babies aren't always born. Mothers can't always breastfeed. We often grieve these losses because they feel so unnatural. Nevertheless, it still feels unwise to choose to limit the full expression of our creatureliness if we don't have to. And then there was the background of my AMBS formation classes. In several of my faith formation classes, we have given special thought to transitions and liminal space. Human beings have always considered darkness to be somewhat scary. Just this week, I was reading in Luke 1, 78 and 79, when Zechariah prophesies, "By the tender mercy of our God, the dawn from on high will break upon us to give light to those who sit in darkness." It made me think of Psalm 130, verse 5. "I wait for the Lord, my whole being waits, and in his word I put my hope. I wait for the Lord more than watchmen wait for the morning." More than watchmen wait for the morning. Considering the way that humans naturally feel a little bit intimidated at nighttime, I suspect that the way babies fall asleep and then experience night wakings may matter. In The Developing Christian, Peter Feldmeyer summarizes Eric Erickson's belief that infancy is at the time when consistency and quality care are registered unconsciously in the infant, producing a sense of security, a sense that the world is good and can be trusted. And my own words and understanding, simply put, the psychological goal of infancy is to develop trust. Given the intimidation that humans feel when confronted by night, it seems that maybe the way parents approach sleep may affect the nuances of the way this trust develops. In Stages of Faith, James Fowler describes this period of faith formation as pre-faith, in which the only spiritual task of infancy is being reliably cared for. Thus, from the perspective of faith formation, I wonder if our adult faith may actually be impacted by early messages that we receive. Perhaps it matters if the primary messages when we are feeling needy or vulnerable are, "Night-night, I'll see you in the morning," versus, "It's time to sleep, I'll see you when you wake up." Or, "Oh, love, I know you aren't that hungry. It's not quite yet time to eat." Contrast this with hearing, "Oh, my boy, how I love feeding you." Furthermore, my experience this last year is that parents' spiritual formation continues being affected by whether our lips most regularly articulate, "Please wait until I finish this," or, "Of course, I can come back to this later." So I knew I wasn't comfortable with much of the advice that I was hearing, but I certainly didn't have a better model. And then I read the book that changed the course of my parenting, and I suspect maybe even my life, The Womanly Art of Breastfeeding. Its main message was that women could trust themselves and their babies. How often should a baby nurse? However often mom and baby want. Where should baby sleep? And whatever arrangement enables everyone in the family to get the best sleep. When and how should baby be weaned? Whenever and however baby and mom want. So, this was the path I chose. On the way, I have been so tempted. Multiple times a day, I think, to compare myself with other moms who have gained independence and better sleep a few months earlier. Women who our culture sees as being far better mothers than myself. But then I think about the times when I've experienced God this last year. And over again, I end up picturing myself in Adam's room, in that rocking chair, nursing and rocking, nursing and rocking, lately in the middle of the night. It has been in those moments, while freely giving my body for the life of another, that I have begun to see some of the distortions I have attributed to God for so many years. Through an attachment parenting style, I am experiencing a different face of God. While nursing and rocking in that chair, I recognized a distance that I often feel between me and God. It was in that chair that I read Psalm 4 with new and very wide eyes. "Answer me when I call to you, my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Have mercy on me and hear my prayer. Fill my heart with joy. In peace I will lie down and sleep. For you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety." Can I really expect God to answer my cries if I'm ignoring those of my baby? Wait. Expect God to answer my cries? Well, no, actually. I don't expect that. I am a perfect product of my culture, in that I only expect God to answer my legitimate and worthy cries. And God is all wise after all, so God knows what's really best for me. And usually what's best is that I become independent, that I grow up and learn to self-soothe. I read of a recent study that took regular samples of baby saliva during a week of sleep training. Typically, cry-it-out methods are very effective and take only a week or so to train a baby to fall asleep without crying. This is their appeal. Babies may cry for over 2 hours on the first night, but then only an hour on the second and 30 minutes on the third. The study, though, revealed that even though babies stopped crying, they continued experiencing elevated levels of cortisol in their saliva, indicating that perhaps they were not learning to self-soothe, but rather maybe they were learning that their cries would not be answered, and so they were giving up. At some point, I stopped expecting God to respond to me. And so I stopped asking much of God. And finally, I stopped hoping much from God. Because I'm just too needy. Wow. That's quite a reality to name. And then I began wondering if I could be wrong. If maybe I'm not too much. If maybe, just as my heart and my body naturally respond to Adam's cries, maybe God's impulse is to respond to mine. Even the cries that are only motivated by my needy, weak, emotional desire to be close. While nursing and rocking in that chair in the middle of the night, I have reflected on the similarities between Adam and me. One thing that mothering has taught me is that people are so different. Some babies crave being held, while others want their own space. But I think Adam and I are quite a bit alike. He started his life sleeping next to my bed, but between 3 and 4 months, he spent increasingly less time next to it, and increasingly more time in it. We were on our way home from a Mother Earth News fair when we stopped at a hotel for the night. They didn't have an elevator, and my husband Steve didn't want to lug his bed up to our room and suggested that Adam just sleep in bed next to me. I, of course, accused him of not caring about Adam's safety. And I laugh when I remember his response. He just looked at me and said, "Alyssa, let's be honest. We haven't set up the co-sleeper since." So for about 7 glorious months, every time Adam would wake up in the middle of the night, he was snuggled right up next to his mama. That was his favorite spot in the whole world. About a month ago, I didn't feel like he was safe in my bed anymore, so I moved him to the crib. Hence, a lot of rocking in the middle of the night. Again, sometimes there are good reasons to bypass our instincts. His safety trumped his instinct of wanting to sleep next to me until he went to school. He is not nearly as happy in his crib. Now, I still go across the hall pretty much whenever he calls for me, but he doesn't sleep nearly as well in that crib as he did next to me in bed. And when I read Psalm 4, I imagine myself awaking with a start, my whole body tensing at the realization of my vulnerability in the middle of my night. smell God. And then I feel God. And I remember that I'm not alone. And then I breathe, my body relaxes, and I can enter back into peaceful sleep. Our Creator designed mothers in God's image to reflect God's care for God's children. Our culture says only nurse for legitimate hunger, but God created nursing to be an analgesic. So the very thing that babies want to do when they get hurt not only comforts them, but also physically reduces their pain. Studies show that 10% of nursing is about nutrition, whereas 90% is the laying down of brain synapses. In the early stages of a baby's life, 100 billion neurons are formed. Skin-to-skin contact, like what a baby experiences while nursing, ignites these neurons. And if they're not activated, the neurons are lost forever. Baby is exposed to something, a virus or bacteria, even if the mother isn't exposed to it, the baby's saliva changes so that when that baby is nursed, his saliva signals to the mother to begin producing antibodies. Again, I am so thankful to live in our culture where we have such amazing options. Nursing is by no means a given, and it by no means has to happen. But why impose such limits on something so important if we don't have to? Our culture says moms must separate eating and sleeping, but God created nursing to produce hormones in both moms and babies that induce drowsiness. Our culture says babies should sleep the night and that moms will be too tired if they have to get up to feed baby. But God created moms and babies so that being physically close actually synchronizes their sleep cycles. So mom and baby are both in light periods of sleep at the same time, which means the baby can wake up and nurse without really disrupting mom's sleep. Our culture says that mom should nurse on a schedule. But mom created a mother's milk supply to fluctuate with her baby's growth spurts. Furthermore, she experiences physical pain if the baby goes longer than normal without nursing. This makes me wonder if God ever aches to nourish me. Our culture proclaims the dangers of scarcity, but God created both cucumber vines and a mother's milk supply to display God's generosity and abundance. The more you give, the more you have. I trust that Adam's first year will continue to bear fruit because it has created in me the drive to encourage parents, especially mothers, to reject our culture's push toward bringing to work with kids instead of giving them more
last time I sang it in community was the opening chapel of the 2013-2014 academic year. I remember it because I had discovered that I was pregnant with Adam only a few hours earlier.